Yeah, so it is windy as fuck over here in Cape Town right now. I was riding back to my house, and it's very unpleasant riding when it's so windy.
Yeah, the wind is pretty cock. I was gonna have a rant about the profile of a typical developer for any sort of video based or podcast based system. You can imagine that they have a Mac. They only ever use Chrome. They've probably got the 16 gigabyte version because that's what the kind of person that they are. They use like a very arbitrary editor, and they've never even heard of someone who uses something like Firefox. You know, they don't even care about security. They can just leave their credentials all over the place.
There's a whole bunch of Chrome-specific web apps just popping up right now, and I kind of get it. Is my company Just Sketch Me? It runs on all browsers, but it was difficult to make it do that. So what I do is I actually use Safari as my development environment. And the reason is not because
lowest common Safari denominator.
Is
the most,
exactly, is if it works in Safari, it theoretically works everywhere else. And so what I've done is I've actually started using Safari as my default browser overall.
Okay.
Just because, you know, it is, again, the most common denominator. And the fact of the matter is that the most of the bugs that I pick up aren't when I'm... Okay, I mean, sure, I pick up bugs when I'm doing developments and stuff, but it's more, you know, if I'm just randomly showing someone something and I'm like, looks like there's a bug there. Gonna have to sort that out. And it actually allows me to more organically find those issues.
Yeah. So you're doing your own sort of QA.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about trust, right? So we had this offsite with my company last week. And, you know, we went for after work drinks and stuff. And then it came out that apparently my microphone has been soft the whole time. So all those times where I thought I was having customer conversations or, you know, talking to people, I think the whole time, like, it must have been like months, like, because I've had that microphone for ages and no one had the guts to tell me that. And to be fair, there was another guy on my team who... they apparently has too loud of a microphone. So I think it's just like, is there no trodden ground on how you tell?
Here's the guy, like, with the soft microphone.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, is there no etiquette on how you tell someone that, hey, like, hey man, like, your microphone's a bit soft, eh? Or you should
maybe people assume that people know. And that it's kind of like, here comes the guy who always types in caps locks.
Yeah. You know, like those people with a mechanical keyboard and you can hear them typing away. And like, it's like, are you even listening to what I'm saying?
Why are you always screaming? What we're going to hop into today, as you know, because we talked about this episode before doing it, because obviously we prep these episodes because we're not podcasting newbies, we're pros. Yeah, I've got a podcast mic and all, and that's how you know that you're a podcast pro, because you got the microphone.
Yeah.
So today we will be talking about the future of transportation in cities. So not necessarily between cities, but what is the ideal situation for moving millions of people every day through their commutes to their friends' houses, coffee shops, errands, the works. And where is it done well? Where is it done badly? What are the impacts on people, the environment, mental health, etc., etc.?
Well, do you want to roll us in first?
Oh, right. Yeah, because we're professional podcasters, so we do intros.
We do. Yeah, this is season two. We're not season one anymore.
Yeah, no, season two intro. Here we go. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Herman and Jason Spin the Yarn. Today we're going to be talking about the transport of the future / present question mark. And
it could be all of them.
I could pose you this question. Where do you think transport is done terribly?
In places where there is no transport. When you don't have a way to get around, you have to walk. Unless you are completely remote, in which case you probably have all of the food you require right next to you. And you've got no need to ever go anywhere, which I think is very rarely the case.
Let's hone in on what you said over there about there is no transport, so you walk. I think I'll say that walking is a very valid form of transport. It really just depends on the context of the walking.
And the length. I mean, if you had to hike a 5K every morning just to get to work, I mean, some people would love it, but if the weather turned bad and you suddenly walking through the rain, you're not going to enjoy it too much. And also, if your toilet was 5K away, or if you had to fetch your groceries from somewhere that was in the other direction.
It's like, hold on, I need to quickly go to the bathroom. I'll see you in 2 hours.
Certainly in the context, you've got some sort of walking mode. I'd say anything that's like too crowded for me. I don't like, especially now I know, you know, things are getting better with the whole thing. But I don't like being too crowded. So, I mean, I think for me, like transport, that's a little bit too crowded, and also unpredictable transport. I'm going to go with that.
All right. All right. So like, I will start off by agreeing with you about, close confines transport to a certain extent as being fairly unpleasant. But I will say that the best transport in the world that we currently have is less about the transport itself and more about the city design around it. So cities that are inherently walkable or cyclable, where things are built to a human scale, actually makes for the best transport system. I think I've mentioned in a previous episode, there's a direct correlation between the physical and mental health of people in cities that are walkable compared to cities that you have to have a car to drive around in. And having a driver-only city also negatively affects people who are of a lower income, because you have to be able to afford a car in order to not just be locked into whatever's in your 5-kilometer radius. And that 5-kilometer radius, when you're in a big drive-only city, is like the McDonald's.
Yeah, I think you get that a lot in America and the urban sprawl of suburbia, where you can't really walk anywhere, actually. I mean, even in parts of South Africa too, you have very unwalkable, maybe not because of the design necessarily, but maybe because of a safety aspect. I think in the same sense as if you have to get into a car and fire up the engine and drive yourself through traffic to get to wherever you need to get to, I think that's not going to be the most fun thing to do, especially if that's your only way of getting around.
I'm going to quickly go on a very, very short tangent, and I'll keep it down to like less than 30 seconds. But I watched a YouTube video today of this person who converted a Land Rover Discovery, one of those old like boys, and it just feels so wrong watching it. I mean, it's great. It's got great torque. It can climb mountains well. But instead of that, of it going up this hill with the minimal slip differentials running, whatever, it just goes, whiz, 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 whiz. And then it, you know, gets over the hill and buzz, buzz, buzz.
How do you know it's on? Like,
right?
You don't even know if the engine's running. I have that. My dad has a Toyota Prius. So if you like, you're driving along, you can hear the engine going, and then you stop at a traffic light, and then the engine just goes. And I think you get that too with a lot more here in the UK. They have these called kind of urban emissions kind of systems that, you know, as you stop at a traffic light, your engine cuts out. So for me, as like a, you know, coming from a student and coming from a third world country, I'm like, whoa, what have I done? Stalled it. Like, go for the key. Oh no, you could just press the pedal and it just like reignites the engine. Mm. Does some sort of crank at the front and just gets everything going again somehow.
So I'm gonna throw another hypothetical question to you. You become the Minister of Transport in the future, quote unquote, the future.
Okay. And the whole of
you
the future.
In Cape Town specifically.
Okay.
And you are given free rein to do whatever you want to improve people getting around in Cape Town. What do you do?
Oh, tricky. The thing is, for getting around, I think the best overall goal would be to be able to walk/cycle/alternative transport anywhere in Cape Town relatively easily. And that would include Century City to some degree. So getting from the waterfront all the way to Musenberg via one pathway/track/roadway. I think that would be really cool. And then also extending to Century City, which I think there is a kind of cycle path that goes pretty far out towards there.
You can theoretically cycle from Musenberg to Cape Town. Andre's done it before. Mm. And you have to cycle on the highway, well, on the shoulder of the highway, which as far as I understand is illegal. But it's doable, so, yeah, and you manage to do it in like an hour and a half.
It would need to be something that's protected. Something that's, people can sit beside. They can hula hoop and roller skate and do all that kind of thing and have a bit of fun getting there. Or they could use e-scooters. That might be quite cool. The thing is, like, as you grow it out, you would need to go kind of step by step, right? Because to make it viable, you can't just, like, build this whole big thing, which is probably going to take, you know, a little bit of budget and, you know, a little bit of effort to get past the powers that be in a political sense. But you need to make it like viable, and you also need to incentivize people to actually use those routes, which would require, you know, ensuring that it's safe, ensuring that it's well lit. Those kind of go hand in hand, making sure that there's like little stops along the way, connections into some of the little towns. I think it would be quite cool.
Google Photos gives you the, 1 year ago today, 2 years ago today. So today, 8 years ago, my bicycle was stolen outside of my commune in Pretoria.
Oh, no.
So just some, pour out some beer for the last.
Why you gotta make it so sad?
And but I do agree with you, is making Cape Town a lot more cycle friendly would go a long way. I would also say that, and this has been shown time and time again, the best way to reduce congestion on the roads is by making these alternatives available and by improving public transport. Now, we currently have a pretty good MyCity bus system in Cape Town, but when you're in the middle class, you have to compare that to taking an Uber. Now, an Uber is 3 or 4 times as expensive as taking the bus, but it'll be at your door now. And the bus runs every half hour. So what I would do to improve overall infrastructure in Cape Town is threefold. The first one is to improve the bus systems by making it go to more places, run every 15 minutes. So you all, when you get to the bus stop, you know that in under 15 minutes, the bus is going to be there, which will change that perception of like, oh, I'm going to wait for an Uber instead, because it'll be a similar time frame. And then the third one would be borrowing from the way that taxis operate and just making the buses a smaller scale, but run more often. Because if you're running every 15 minutes, you don't necessarily need to have as big a bus. And this will, you know, theoretically make it a bit more efficient of a process, and smaller buses are cheaper, et cetera, et cetera. The second one is making bus lanes dedicated, especially during peak traffic, and potentially even reducing the number of car lanes and making bus lanes more predominant throughout the city. And this is going to piss off motorists for a little bit, but then they'll realize that they can take the bus. And then the third one is what you said, improving cycle and walking infrastructure, having separate bike lanes. Like currently in Woodstock, which is this very busy part of Cape Town with lots of cars going up and down, and there are cycle lanes technically, but it's just a painted gutter on the side of the road. And it is harrowing. It is dangerous to cycle on that thing, because that's where people pull off to park or stop or pick up passengers, et cetera, et cetera. So you really need that separate roadway. Because if you talk to anyone and say, like, why don't you cycle in Cape Town? They're like, how the fuck am I cycling in Cape Town?
It's dangerous, yeah. I like the approach that they take in some of the European cities, is that they have, like, cars parked on the outside, and then there's, like, the cycle lane that's inside, and then they've got the pedestrian lane. So the cars kind of act, when they park, they act as, like, a barrier that can protect people. I think that's important.
That would actually work in Woodstock as well, because you've currently got the cycle lane and then parking. So in order to get into parking, you have to go over the cycle lane, which kind of defeats the point of it.
Here's an alternative, though. So I've been in a couple of European cities in the last 6 months or so, trying to build more plaza, like more sort of space. And I've been like trying to figure it out, because in places like Woodstock, which are quite, I would say, dense. I mean, and for those who aren't familiar with Woodstock, it's quite a dense, sort of quite urbanized environment, not in the center of Cape Town, but more kind of, I would say, outskirtish, but still kind of definitely part of Cape Town. You've got a bit of pavement, which acts as both the pavement and the sides of the, you've got your shops and it's only like one pavement, and I'd say it's maximum about 2 meters wide. But if you look at some of the European pavements, they are a lot longer, which means that you're taking up road space. And I've seen a couple of places, and especially here in the UK, where they're trying to make accommodations for people with COVID or lines that are outside certain buildings. They take bollards and they basically block off more space into the road. And I'd say maybe about like 5 or 6 meters would be enough. And then you can get to a stage where you can have people that put, you know, stuff outside. And in that case, you can get like tables and chairs outside, and then you can have more of an outside plaza area, which is what, and trying to figure out like, how do you get a plaza into somewhere like Long Street, for instance, because when you're sitting there, it's very dense. There's lots of cars. You kind of have to get rid of some of the cars and just make yourself some more pavement.
With Long Street specifically, they've started cordoning it off every Thursday, Friday, Saturday evening, I think. Certainly Saturdays from, I think it's 5 o'clock in the evening, something like that. And it is awesome. So all of the bars and restaurants sprawl out onto the street. There's even like little dance stages on the street. There's live music performances. It is such a vibe. And I wish they did this a long time ago. I would like to see more of that in cities. Absolutely. With regard to what you said about cordoning, I think one of the ways that that could be done, especially in, say, Woodstock, is to turn a lot of the two-way roads into one-way roads. So again, it's going to be a little bit inconvenient to motorists. But as it currently stands, a lot of those roads already operate as like one-way roads because one half of the road is used for parking. So yeah, by making the roads a bit thinner, one way with parking and then cycle and walking paths.
I think the other thing that needs to come into play is also getting people into the city. So we still have quite a disconnected city in terms of the central CBD, the city bowl itself, and then you've got the suburbs. So if you wanted to entice people from the suburbs to come and visit Cape Town, you would need to have some form of parking. If you're clever, you can go to places like the waterfront. They've got relatively low cost parking, I would say. So if someone was to come in, and I think they have it in Amsterdam, there's like a big parking lot and everyone parks their cars there and then they can walk the rest of the way. And in some cases, you can park your car on like a more longer term basis so that you live and walk around the streets in the city and you live in the city. But if you need to commute, you need to go outside the town, you can go pick up your car from the parking lot and go, you know, do what you need to do. So increasing parking infrastructure, I think that's quite critical to at least get people to move, to at least come and visit. Because if you want more people to come to Long Street, they need to be able to park their car and, you know, they need to be able to have somewhere, you know, some way of getting there rather than making it too inclusive of just the people who are in the city bowl.
One of the options over there is, again, increasing the frequency and reach of the buses and extending the working hours of the buses. Because if you could take, man, it would be great if you could take the bus from the burbs into Long Street and then go and have a night out. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, take the bus back. But unfortunately, the bus stops running at 9:30, which is not ideal.
The yellow and gray elephant in the room, which is also that we do have, in fact, a train. Improving the train, I've taken that train a couple of times. So the train goes from the center of Cape Town, to which is basically a Cape Town Central Station, and it goes all the way along the southern suburbs and can go all the way up into Simonstown, which is like a little coastal town, 1/10 of the way along the peninsula. So if you look at Cape Town, you see this big sort of peninsula. It's a little bit along the edge.
That train ride is possibly one of the most beautiful rides in the world, if you could see out the windows, but the windows have all been graffitied over.
When it comes to like more sort of higher end infrastructure, and that's where it kind of starts to get a bit tricky, because if you were to upgrade that train, it's something that's more, well, it would help tourism, which in the long run would be beneficial, but it would also potentially be helping people who are just doing it for fun rather than people who are trying to commute into the town. So it's a pretty slippery slope that you just, you know, let's upgrade this one road, which is this one train, and forget about, you know, people who are trying to commute in, and that could cause a bit of tension as a transport minister of the future.
Right. I would love to see more train transport, especially in Africa, just because it is one of the most efficient ways to move people around. It requires very, very little maintenance. I mean, like, obviously it requires a decent amount of maintenance and it is expensive, but a rail, it just works. The lines go down and it'll work for an extraordinarily long time with very little maintenance when compared to a road, which needs to be resurfaced and it gets cracked in the sun and the rain and potholed and then boopity boopity bop. So there's actually a rail that runs under the highway past the docks in Cape Town, down past the V&A waterfront, but on the cruise terminal side. And I always assumed that it was an abandoned rail because I'd never seen a train on it until this past weekend, where a big freight train came through, dropped off some stuff at the cruise terminal, and then left again. And that actually kind of threw me. So it is firmly possible to carry on using existing rail infrastructure and then upgrading the carts and the stations. I think that it's really tough for, and this kind of ties into our last episode a little bit, it's kind of tough for politicians to push for such large infrastructure upgrades because they probably won't be in office to see it concluded.
Yeah, but I mean, you kind of need to take a more longer term approach, because first of all, you know, large infrastructure projects can bring jobs to a area or a country. So if you were to upgrade a port, for instance, or create a port, that can create a lot of jobs, although temporary, but you know, it does form little economies around that. Mm-hmm. They can be beneficial, but I think it's also, it's very hard to quantify long-term benefits. Yeah, pretty much like we talked last time, it's very hard to quantify that long-term benefit in a short-term sort of political cycle. Yeah. There is if you go down to the, I don't know if it's still there, but they did have a kind of a new version of the trains that they were trying to advertise. So if you go down to Cape Town Central Station, there was one of these like newer passenger train kind of replicas that they were showing off, saying like, this is what it could look like. And it's kind of that thing, you got to make people aware. And we've obviously got a very big history of burning things. And
so one of the things that happens in South Africa fairly often is that the owners of the taxi companies or the taxi companies go and destroy infrastructure that competes with them. So this could involve like burning trains or buses. So with the expansion of the MyCity bus and the expansion of the train system, there have been a couple of proposed solutions. And one of them has been to essentially give taxi bosses some of a stake, essentially equity in the city bus program, which would make it essentially partly theirs, which would go hopefully some way in preventing that kind of violence from breaking out, because it is a very unfortunate thing when we try and improve infrastructure but it is destroyed, not because of like civil unrest or stuff like that, but literally because of competing interests.
It's a very cutthroat kind of way of doing a free, well, it's not a free market, right? Because in a free market, you would have competitors and that would lead to an improvement of the service, either in terms of the cost or in terms of innovation. Like if I can innovate and, you know, do something a little bit better, but then someone comes after me in a violent sense, it's not creating the market economics that we need in order to improve everyone, right? Because, you know, someone could find a way of doing it better. You know, I think there was all these kind of apps that are looking to try and provide some sort of consistency to the way that people have these sort of informal transport systems. So like, you know, an app that automatically tracks when, you know, certain taxis are leaving a certain area. Those kind of innovations, I think, would lead to more reliability, because I think the one thing that's the worst is if you expect a train to be there or you expect a bus to be there and it's not there and you have to wait for a while. If you at least know what time it's going to come, roughly, you can kind of plan your day around it. But I think the thing is the unpredictability. So, you know, you go there in the morning, you're like waiting for an indeterminate amount of time. So sometimes you'll have to try and get there early and make sure that you're there on time, or, you know, and that's wasting time.
Elon Musk keeps on trying to get involved in public infrastructure projects. And so let's take, for instance, the concept that, hey, you know, we want trains to run on time or buses to run on time, and we want them to deliver us where we're going. And this is very descriptive of like tech bro culture, where they're like, okay, the best solution is the most high-tech solution. It's creating a vacuum-tubed underground system that runs on maglev and, you know, just pops you from point A to point B. Or it includes that when that is deemed to be a stupid idea, because it's a really dumb idea, literally the best solutions are the simplest solutions, especially when it comes to scale. And so then that gets downgraded to, okay, but what if everyone drove Teslas in tunnels? And it's like, okay, but what happens if something goes wrong? Like, how do you reverse all the Teslas out of there? And so it's all of these very, very simple problems that we've actually solved. And it's called a subway, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, public transport infrastructure is I'd say that one of the problems with a lot of technical solutions to these problems is that the problems actually have solutions. We've seen these problems solved in other cities to varying degrees, some awesomely, some not so well. So it's not necessarily about creating a novel solution. It's about figuring out a novel way to implement a good solution.
I guess there's always a kind of desire and like to push the boundaries. And I guess like that's a philosophical thing that you said is like, you know, all good solutions are simple solutions. I don't think necessarily that's the case, but there is a tendency, you know, for people to want to break new ground and do things that have never been done before and be like, you know, on the front cover of Forbes because you're creating aero taxis and these kind of things. But what I think is that where the bulk of the innovation will come, and I'm starting to see this more and more, is that improvements to current infrastructure, like, you know, take a manufacturing plant and figure out what are the inputs, what are the outputs, and how can you make it more efficient at doing what it's doing. Take a transportation system. How can you figure out what are the flows? Where are the people going? What are they doing? What time do you need to be there? Provide that information to, you know, the people that need it, and, you know, improve the systems we got. And I think there would be remarkable differences. Obviously, there's room for improvements in terms of like the last mile delivery problem and like the last mile problem just in general. And I mean, I'd say like even with like personalized deliveries and things, I don't necessarily, having lived in the UK for a bit, I don't necessarily think it works. I'll tell you why, because like you order a package for something and you have to get it delivered to your house. But like, it's fine when you're in lockdown and stuff where you're at your house. But what happens when you're not at your house and it's a package and it doesn't fit through the mailbox and you don't have like a mailbox?
I literally was dealing with that this morning. Is I got a phone call from my housemate saying like, hey man, are you home? I'm like, no, I'm not home. He's like, there's a package being delivered.
Just help him get the grand piano up. Don't worry. it's just a small grand piano. So just help him carry it in. But that's the thing. Like, I you order something and then they deliver it and then it like bounces. And then you've got, I imagine there's like a reverse logistics problem where you basically have a package going back to sender or goes into the depot. And like, I was thinking like how much time is being wasted and how much energy is being spent redelivering this package back because I wasn't at home for like a brief moment in time. So like having more structure around like, hey, when are you going to be home? Like, let's deliver it on time. Or what I like to do is get it delivered to one of these kind of delivery boxes and just go pick it up myself, because at least I know like 100%.
I've got delivery or package receival at my new co-working space. So they're like, oh, Herman, here's your package. And the nice thing about the co-working space is that it's very easy to find, big sign, and there's a security person there's a front security booth, and the guy goes and hands the package to them. Mm-hmm. And then when I next walk through the door, they flag me down. But also what's quite nice about it is that it's open 24/7. So it doesn't really matter if Take a Lot decides that it's going to do a Sunday delivery. That's fine.
Yeah,
that's good.
I think it's underrated, and I think going to the shops is underrated, you know, like I've ordered a few things online that haven't turned out to be what I expected. So and sometimes I'm quite particular when I buy, especially like sort of high ticket things. I like to make sure I'm getting the right thing. And I've made one or two sort of, you know, fuck ups.
So on that note and on along that vein is we're nearing the end of February, but throughout all of February I didn't do any food ordering. It becomes so easy to order food. You just open up Uber Eats or Mr. D or whatever, and you're like, what am I feeling? I feel like, and then you kind of scroll for a bit, and then you're like, okay, I kind of feel like a chicken burger. So you order that, and then it takes 45 minutes, and when it gets to you, it's cold, and it's actually it's a pretty shit experience.
Yeah.
And it leverages on the fact that you as a human are a lazy fuck.
Right? You're too damn lazy to go get your own meal.
Yeah, all of February, I haven't done that. It's, Emma and I set a little thing. We're like not going to order in throughout all of February. And it's actually been quite nice. Is we go out to eat, you know, to a restaurant like two, three times a week. And we'll make a nice meal like two times a week. But then the rest of the time, we'll just like whip something together, right? And you just have to like make sure that you've got like some chickpeas and that you've got some rice and that you've got some this and that. And then you can just quickly slap together something in literally the amount of time that I would spend trying to figure out what I wanted on the app. And it's actually, it actually removes that cognitive burden where it's like, what do I have? Okay, I've got chickpeas, I've got some spinach, I've got some rice and lentils and some curry powder. It looks like I'm having a chickpea biryani. Right.
You've got some go-tos.
Yeah. Instead of like literally any food that I could possibly want. Do I want sushi? Maybe, but I don't really want the option. It's fucking lunch.
Exactly. I think the best transport would be one that stops by somewhere really nice where you can have something to eat on the way home. I'll put that in. So, because you know, like if you can have a great transportation system that goes via, you know, certain areas, then you can kind of rely on it and say, I'm going to go out there to this little area, go grab a little snack on the way home. Sometimes, you know, a snack will do. You don't necessarily need to have a full meal, but
I think that's one of the benefits of having lots of smaller, preferably independent shops, but let's just say lots of smaller shops and mixed use areas, is that like if I'm, and I've done this multiple times, across the road from me, there's a little spaza shop. Well, not really a spaza shop. It's called Coronation Bazaar. We call it the everything store because you can get fresh mushrooms and caraway seeds and drill bits and
some motor oil.
Yeah, some motor oil. You can actually get motor oil there and a fishing net, right? Mm. So it's got a little bit of everything, and I can go and I can make a pretty wholesome meal from there if I want to. And it doesn't have a lot of the stuff that I would, like, I can't plan a meal and then go in there and buy the stuff. Instead, I go in there, I see what they have, I buy that. Today he's got mushrooms, tomorrow he might have, you know, some fresh cauliflower or whatever. And the nice thing about having a lot of decentralized little shops is that instead of you having to make a trip to the box store, to the spa or whatever, is it's like, okay, it's time for me to go home. I walk out of the co-working space. I go to Nude Foods. I get all the stuff I want for dinner. Then I hop on the bus and then I'm home. And that's actually a really nice little system, as opposed to me having to take transport to the spa and then get transport from the spa home. Yeah, for those of you who are not South African, a Spar is kind of like a Lidl or a
Co-op,
whatever,
Tesco's.
Co-op, Tesco's, yeah, that's the ones.
They do actually have, they had Spars in Spain when I was there, which the one I saw was actually closed down. But I think the only thing that I don't necessarily like about public transport is if you have to carry anything large, or you have to figure out how to move things that are larger than something that you can fit in your backpack or carry in a plastic bag. Like if you wanted to order desk, or you wanted to sell a monitor, or you wanted to, you know, get something like a table lamp or something like that, you pretty much have to lug that thing. You either lug that thing along the tube, or you have to like figure out, you know, is there some sort of intermediary delivery system? Can you get like two men in a van?
It also depends on where you are. It's like in Cape Town, I just get an Uber because they're so inexpensive over here. And I'd say that Uber does fill a very good niche in, I say Uber, but I mean any ride sharing service, It just happens that Uber is the largest one in the world, and not without its problems, but my life is significantly better because Uber exists.
It's actually interesting because it's like if I think about it in the way that Uber works here, it's kind of like the taxi situation in Cape Town. Is that Uber here is actually quite expensive because I think at one point there was a whole sort of uproar from the taxi because obviously the London cabbie is a very prized thing in London. But Uber was obviously undercutting them for, you know, good or bad reasons. I think some would say that, you know, undercutting them at that point. It's a bit troublesome. But so I think there's now like, I think it's legally binding, or it's a legal thing that they have to go via, like Uber has to go via the taxi associations or a taxi company. And they actually, you know, prop up the price of Uber compared to other taxis, which means like for the taxi drivers, yeah, that makes sense. But in terms of innovation, it just means that the kind of taxi providers can continue doing what they're doing and not necessarily innovate. Whereas, to be fair, like there are some apps now that come and you can actually order a taxi via an app. So in the same sense, but without that kind of, you know, competitiveness and having your cage rattled, you can't really, you know, have that sort of innovation.
So let's take, for instance, the London cabs and Uber are competing over there. London cabs are protected by the government, right? And then Uber is protected by investor money. And what I mean by that is like every time you take an Uber ride is you are riding on investor dime, right? Is the price of an Uber is actually cheaper than it should be. And you're essentially using investor money to subsidize part of your trip. So while London cabs are being subsidized by the government,
is that better than tax Uber's money?
I mean, I don't know.
I kind of get it. I think in the initial phases, it does cause a bit of a stir. I think the problem is with Uber that they kind of create a barrier to entry, right? So I'm okay for competitive environments, but I think when you create a competitive environment and then you immediately put up a really big wall that prevents other competitors, I think that is where it kind of comes in to something that I dislike. I think what probably happened, I don't know the complete details of, you know, the London Taxi Co. v. Uber Inc. or whatever was the case, but it's, I think, again, it goes to our kind of, or my view on government is like more setting the guardrails of like, okay, sure, we've got a competitor in the space. We don't want to prevent innovation because surely the reason why Uber's so pervasive is because it's doing something that, you know, other companies aren't able to do, which is basically order an Uber and not have to, you know, call a phone, or even some people don't want to lift their hand outside, or, you know, you want to have some sort of reliability that when you get outside your house that you're going to have a taxi waiting there. So you have the innovation part, but also you don't, you know, want to give all this money to some American company. People who don't have money coming in, especially the taxi drivers, you don't want to have them not have a job. So it's kind of like a balancing act, but government kind of just sets the rules and says like, hey, like how can we allow innovation but also, you know, kind of keep it the same. But
I feel you. So we have figured it out, the best way to improve transport,
depending on how futuristic it is, we might just be teleporting everywhere, right?
I mean, that would be pretty neat.
I think everyone would just get like really large because you wouldn't have to walk anywhere. You just, or would it be? It would be like a central teleportation depot where you like go in, you get teleported.
It's kind of like a bus station.
Yeah,
right?
So you get. I mean, you still have to get.
What are bus stations? But just like little teleportation depots.
I mean, yeah,
they just happen to take 20 minutes.
I mean, if you take a sleeping pill on an airplane, you get a similar feeling. You basically fall asleep in one location, wake up in a complete other side of the world. It's quite a remark. But I think we're getting to the bottom of something. Basically, like, yeah, I don't know if you want to close us off or give us a little anecdote.
I think it's more just that the future of transportation is actually just overall better city infrastructure. It's not any one technology. It's the combination of better living spaces overall that are built at a human scale.
Yeah, I'd also say maybe if you can get the cars away from people. So either in undergrounds or elevated.
So a subway.
Yeah, I mean, like, because I think the thing is, you want to increase, again, you want to increase the amount of walkable space, the amount of cyclable space, but how you do that, whether you raise traffic, you divert it, or you put it underground, I think those are the ways you need to be looking at.